We are creatures of ideas, or so we like to think, especially at a place like this where we've come to exchange pieces of creativity and innovation and all these wonderful bargaining chips of ego and identity. But these ideas that we take such great pride in are not really our own. When epiphany shakes us up by the shoulders and a light bulb flares up, in fact, our brain has been consolidating pieces of information for hours and days and perhaps even years, combining and recombining them into new configurations until they click and come to this new idea, our idea. It's a concept that's infinitely exciting and at the same time very uncomfortable, and it's one of the many ways in which our conscious cognition bumps up against the seemingly impenetrable curtain of our unconscious mind. Here to pull the curtain is neuroscientist and possibilian David Eagleman.
Thanks, Maria. Well, thank you guys for being here. It's a real pleasure to be back here at South by Southwest. Here's what I want to talk with you about, the brain. As far as we can tell, we're the only species that has grown sufficiently complex that we have thrown ourselves headlong into this game of deciphering our own programming language. So this would be as if your computer started controlling its own peripheral devices and pulled off its own cover and pointed its webcam at its own circuitry and tried to figure itself out. That's the situation we're in, and what we have discovered under the hood is the most complicated thing that we have ever found in the universe. So the brain weighs about 3 pounds. It has tens of billions of neurons. Neurons are the specialized cell types in the brain, and each neuron is about as complicated as the city of Austin. So every single neuron has the entire human genome in it, and it's trafficking millions of proteins, and these neurons are connected to each other in such staggering complexity that it bankrupts the English language and forces us to invent new strains of mathematics to even try to describe these forests of connections. So because each neuron is connected to about 10,000 of its neighbors, what that means is that there are hundreds of trillions of connections in the brain. So if you were to take just a cubic millimeter of brain tissue, there are as many connections in there as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So it's a tremendously complex system. But it's not just the complexity that's the interesting part. The interesting part is this realization that our species has made that somehow all of your hopes and dreams and aspirations and fears, joys, everything is contained in this 3-pound, vast, wet electrochemical network that we call the nervous system. Now, how do we know that? How do you know that you are in your brain as opposed to some other part of your body? Well, imagine that you were to damage a part of your pinky in a car accident. You would be sad about that, but you would be no different as a person. But if you were to damage an equivalently sized chunk of brain tissue, that can change you entirely. That could change your decision-making, your risk aversion, your capacity to simulate possible futures and evaluate them, your ability to see colors or understand music or name animals. All of those are things that we see when people damage their brain. And that's how we know that somehow these 3 pounds is the densest representation of you. Now, the really surprising part is that this vast network runs essentially all of its operations under the hood. So if you take something like lifting a bottle of water to your mouth, that's actually underpinned by a lightning storm of neural activity. There's a lot going on to make that happen. It's a very complicated act, and any of you who have been involved in robotics, for example, know that getting the pressures and the angles and everything just right is actually still an unsolved problem. It's all happening under here, but if it weren't for neurobiology, we wouldn't even have reason to suspect the existence of nerves and tendons and muscles and electrical signals. Why? Because it's completely invisible to us. You're not aware of any of that action at all. It's like when you make a credit card transaction, and it seems like it's just a simple act, but it only seems simple because of this massive international networked server farm that lives behind every one of those transactions, right? So that's what it's like when you lift a bottle of water to your mouth, but it's not just the bottle of water, it's everything. It's walking, it's recognizing a friend's face, it's getting a joke, it's driving a car, falling in love. All of these things are underpinned by lightning storms of neural activity, and yet we're not aware of any of it. It's all running under the hood. And that's what leads to this concept of the unconscious. It turns out that most of what you do and act and believe is all generated by parts of your brain that you have no access to, and for the most part, no acquaintance with at all. So the conscious mind, the part of you that you think of as I, the part that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning, that's the broom closet in the mansion of the brain. It has access to very little of what's going on. One of the analogies that I use in my book Incognito is that the conscious mind is like a stowaway on a transatlantic steamship that's taking credit for the whole journey without acknowledging all the massive engineering underfoot. So think, for example, when you have an idea and you say, hey, I just thought of something. Well, it wasn't really you that thought of it, right? Your brain's been working on that for days or weeks behind the scenes, consolidating information, putting things together, simulating possible solutions and evaluating them. And at some point when it's ready, it serves it up to your consciousness and you say, hey, I'm a genius. But it wasn't really you, right? So that's the situation we're in. And as Carl Jung summarized this, he said, in each of us, there is another whom we do not know. And as Pink Floyd said, there's someone in my head, but it's not me. So I'll give you an example of this. There was an experiment some years ago where men were asked to rate the attractiveness of women in photographs. And so they looked at the photos and they rated each woman from 1 to 10, level of attractiveness. What the men didn't know is that in half the photographs, the women's eyes had been dilated by some eye drops. So it turns out that the men uniformly ranked the women higher with dilated eyes. But the important part is that none of the men said, oh, I noticed her pupil was a millimeter larger over here than over here. And presumably, none of the men knew that dilated eyes is a sign of sexual readiness in women. But their brains knew, whoop, and it drove them in the right direction. They made the right choices. What they were doing was running deep evolutionary programs that were causing them to do the right thing, but completely unaware to them, to the men. It turns out if your name is Dennis or Denise, you are more likely to become a dentist. This is a statistically provable thing. All you have to do is go through any dentist professional registry and you can prove this to yourself. Now, why would that happen? It's because people like things that remind them of themselves. This is known as implicit egotism in psychology. But this is completely unconscious. If you were to ask any of these Dennis or Denises why they became a dentist, they would have some conscious narrative about why they like teeth and it's a good profession and so on. Presumably, they don't know about these unconscious pulls because that's a terrible reason to choose a profession, right? But there it is. It's a statistically provable effect. There are many things like this that influence our behavior and we're not even aware of it. Another example, and another one you can prove to yourself by going through the marriage registries of any county and doing the math on it, is that you're more likely to marry somebody whose name begins with the same first letter as your name. So Joel and Jenny, or Alex and Amy, or Donnie and Daisy, people are more likely to marry each other with matching names. That's a terrible reason to choose a life mate, right? And if you ask people their conscious narrative on it, presumably that wouldn't be a part of it, and yet there it is. It's statistically provable. There are lots of things like this. It turns out if your name is Virginia, you're more likely to move to the state of Virginia. Some colleagues of mine did a study where if they give you a questionnaire about your political preferences, if they have you standing near a hand sanitizer, your political preferences become more conservative than if you're standing on the other side of the room from it. It's an unconscious influence about outside threat. Strange, but provably true. Again, it's an unconscious influence. One more is, if you're holding a warm mug of coffee, you will describe your relationship with your mother as being closer than if you're holding an iced coffee. Okay, So there's this giant gap between what your mind has access to and what your brain is doing under the hood, all the operations and computations that it's making under the hood. So why is there this gap? Well, it turns out that's what you want. The conscious mind is there to be sort of like a newspaper headline. So if you think about what's happening in a nation at any given moment, there's a lot of stuff happening. There are factories running, there are cops chasing criminals, there are secretaries answering phone calls. There are lots of things happening. You don't actually care about that. When you pick up a newspaper, what you want is the headline. You just want to know the top-level story about what's going on in the world. And that's exactly what the conscious mind gives you, is just that top-level domain. So it would be like, I think a good analogy to what the conscious mind is doing, I asked them to make this just like a disco club, and I think they're doing a terrific job. The conscious mind is really there to be like the CEO of a company, right? The CEO, I mean, take a big company like Continental Airlines, or the former Continental Airlines, now United. The CEO, he's you know, got 100,000 people underneath him. He can't possibly know about all the machinery of the company, nor would he want to know that. If he's worrying about the software versions on people's desktop and where the cafeteria is ordering their bread rolls and so on, he's mucking with the operation in a way that's going to slow everything down. And that's exactly the same with consciousness. It doesn't have access. It's specifically barred from access to the lower levels of the system because it would merely slow everything down and muck it up. So let me give you an example. So everyone hold up your two dry erase markers. Everyone hold up two dry erase markers in front of you. Okay, hold them up. All right, sign your name forwards and backwards, mirror image. So do your signature like that. Okay, some of you did better than others on that. It turns out it's easy to do this, but only if you don't think about it. As soon as you think about what you're doing, you're dead, right? Because when the conscious mind is interfering in something, you're unable to make it happen. Whereas if you just zen out, it'll work perfectly fine. For any of you who play piano or any instrument, you know that you can do these incredibly complex operations, but as soon as you start paying attention to what your fingers are doing, you're dead, right? You can't possibly keep up with that. In Incognito, my book, I put sort of an insider neuroscience joke, which is if you are ever losing a game of tennis and you really want to win, there is always a way to do it, which is you just compliment your opponent on her serve. You say, wow, you serve so well. How do you do it exactly? And then she can't do it anymore. So it's a nefarious way to always get where you're going there. When I was younger, I played baseball, and my coach used to say to us, I want you guys to think out there. And I said, actually, you don't want us to think out there. What you want us to do is practice a sufficient number of hours that we automatize the behaviors and don't have to think about it when we're out there. He never bought it, so I had to write a book on it eventually, which I mailed to him. Here's another example. So I want everyone to hold your steering wheel. So everyone grab your steering wheel. You're driving on Cesar Chavez Boulevard, and I want you to make a left lane change. So go ahead and change in your left lane. Okay. I didn't see anyone use their blinker, but this is Austin, so that's fine. Okay, as far as I could tell, everybody did it wrong. So what I saw everybody do was turn to the left and turn back. That would steer you onto the sidewalk. The right way to make a lane change is to go to the left, back to the center, through the center, just as far to the right, and back to the center again. That's what a lane change looks like. And you do it every day, but you don't even know how you're doing it. It's kind of amazing, right? So it turns out most of our lives are that way. Almost everything that we attribute to cognition is running under the hood. It's all running incognito, where we can't see what's happening there. Now, I think this behooves us, in general, to look at what our brain is serving up to us in terms of reality. So take something like vision. So you open your eyes and voila, there's the world in all of its golds and blues and colors and shapes and textures. It seems really straightforward, right? But in fact, it only seems effortless to us because of the massive machinery. About a third of the human brain is devoted to constructing this illusion of vision. And if it weren't for all that machinery, we would be able to tell how much effort is going into that. And so one of the ways that we as neuroscientists get at this issue is by looking at visual illusions, which is something that's very interesting to third graders and then to neuroscientists when they grow up. But here, you guys have probably seen some of these before, but I want you to look at this middle bit, and I want you to ask if this surface here is darker than that surface there, right? I mean, it's a dimmer surface. If I cover up the middle, what you'll see is they're exactly the same, right? And I want you to hold up your finger like this so that you're covering that middle bit yourself, so you know I'm not pulling anything funny there. If you cover it yourself, you'll see they're exactly the same. If you pass a photometer over those, they've got exactly the same luminance. So what's going on? Well, it turns out that your brain constructs reality. Your brain takes in some amount of information, and it puts together a story of what's out there. This happens to be something called the corn sweet illusion. It has to do with the gradient that's there, and your brain makes assumptions and spreads that out over the surface. The details don't matter. What I want to illustrate is that what we take to be reality actually needs to be questioned very deeply. Who would believe me that that middle square and that middle square are exactly the same color? It turns out they're identical, and if I cover everything else up, you'll see that they're exactly the same. And all I'm doing, I'm not pulling anything funny except for masking out everything else. What happens is your brain looks at all the colors, the shadows, the play of light, and it decides what colors it thinks things are, and that's what it feeds up to you as your reality, and that's what you accept as your reality, right? But it's all because of these unconscious machinations under the hood. And it turns out that most of what you're staring right at, what's right in front of your eyes, you don't even see. So I'm going to show you two photographs, A and B, and I'm going to alternate them. And I just want you to raise your hand when you see what the difference is between them. So don't shout it out. Just raise your hand when you see what the difference is between A and B and A and B. Okay, a few people, about 5%. For those of you who haven't seen, it's the railing that's moving a foot each time behind the man and the woman, right? That's a huge change in the scene. How could you not see it? 90% of you didn't see it. Okay, for those of you who didn't do so well, I'll give you one more shot here. Again, raise your hand. Raise your hand when you see what the difference is. Okay, about 5-7%. For those of you who haven't seen, it's just the 10,000-pound jet engine here that's appearing and disappearing every time. Okay, how could you not see something right in front of your face? Well, it's kind of shocking, right? What it illustrates is that reality isn't exactly what we think it is. And it turns out that the bottom line is that vision is not like a camera. We're not just, you know, despite what you might learn in a high school or a college textbook about vision, all of that's completely wrong. It's not that photons are hitting the eyes and working their way up some perceptual machinery and then you see the world. It's not like that at all. In fact, essentially, everything about vision has to do with internal activity. You have a model of what you think is going on in the world, and you have a little bit of data that's dribbling in through these two holes in your skull, and that merely anchors that activity. And what happens with this internal activity is if suddenly you lose your vision, that'll spin off in its own direction, which is why when people go in sensory deprivation chambers or get locked into solitary confinement, why they start having hallucinations. Because it's the same process of vision, it just isn't being anchored now. And in fact, we all know this in some sense, right? Because you don't even need your eyes for seeing. Every night when you go to sleep and you dream, you have full, rich visual experience, but your eyes are closed. It's exactly the same process going on in the visual system of your brain. Being awake is essentially awake dreaming. It's exactly the same process that happens when you're dreaming. It's just that it's being anchored. Okay, so this is all pretty strange, right? And the key is that your brain is doing all sorts of computations under the hood. It serves it up to you, and we accept the reality that's presented to us. So here, for example, is a picture I took in India recently, and this is what reality would look like to you if you're colorblind, and if you have color vision, then it looks like that. Either way, you accept it. We now have reason to suspect that something like maybe up to 35% of the female population has not just three types of color photoreceptors, but four types of color photoreceptors in their retinas, which means that they're seeing colors that the rest of us aren't even seeing, which might explain some marital strife in some cases. But the issue is they're seeing reality totally differently than we are. We've, of course, known for a long time that honeybees and rattlesnakes are seeing in the infrared and the ultraviolet range. They're picking up on different parts of the world. Their reality is completely different as a result. So this leads to this old conundrum, this old philosophical conundrum about how do I actually know that my colors are the same as your colors? How would we know if they're different on the inside, right? So what you call purple and I call purple, we both agree to call it purple because our mothers taught us to label it that way. but it might look totally different to me on the inside, because colors don't actually exist in the outside world. All you have is electromagnetic radiation of different wavelengths. The color itself is a construction of the brain. So how do we know it's the same on the inside? Well, it turns out it's probably worse than that. It's what I call reality and what you call reality might be completely different. My reality could be completely upside down from yours, and it wouldn't matter as long as we can transact and negotiate in the outside world. You say, hey, pass me the purple thing, and I hand you the purple thing, and it doesn't matter if our realities are completely different. Now, this used to be in the realm of a philosophical conundrum, but nowadays we can elevate that to a real scientific problem. So one of the ways that we do that in my laboratory is by studying something called synesthesia. Everyone's heard the term anesthesia, which means no feeling. Synesthesia is where there's a blending of the senses, where senses are combined with each other. So, for example, in this automatic, involuntary condition, somebody might taste something, and it causes a visual experience of colors and textures and movement. So, in other words, the taste part of the brain is cross-talking with the part of the brain involved in vision. And again, what we find in synesthesia is that it's unconscious, involuntary, and automatic. Now, that's all the animal research I'm going to show. The rest of this is in humans because synesthesia is a uniquely human issue. This is one of the most common forms. It's where things like numbers or letters or weekdays or months have a color associated with them. And this isn't some sort of, you know, thinking through the color association. This is an automatic equivalence where for this person, Wednesday is magenta and S is green and February is yellow. They're self-evidently equivalent to this person. Now, for each synesthete, the connection between, let's say, the color, the number, the letter, and the color is unique. So every synesthete's going to look different. Now, it used to be thought that this was very rare, something like 1 in 20,000 people. We now know that this is up to 4% of the population. So that means several people in here have. I'm just curious, who in this room has synesthesia? Okay, that's about 4%. So it turns out this is much more common than previously thought. And what it illustrates is that the person sitting next to you might see reality differently than you see reality. And it used to be thought a while ago that maybe people were just being artistic or metaphorical or poetic, or they were on drugs. But it turns out we now know this is a genuine perceptual phenomenon. And I'll tell you in a minute how we measure that nowadays. There are many different forms of synesthesia. For example, sound might get translated into vision. So here's a woman. This is what she sees every time her furnace kicks on and goes whoosh. That's what she sees physically. Here's a man who, when he puts a taste in his mouth, he has a feeling on his fingertips. So his tactile system is tickled into activity by food in his mouth. And this is how he knows how to cook, because when the chicken is pointy, that means it's just right and so on. Musical colors is very common, where synesthetes with this have very particular colors that are associated with notes or with chords or with instrument timbres. And this is an extremely common form here called spatial sequence synesthesia, where things like the months or years or numbers are laid out in a spatial array so that when the person thinks about, let's say, the months, February's over here and March is here and April's here, they can sort of point at where things are. And this is very common. Out of curiosity, how many people have spatial sequence synesthesia? Okay, great. Okay, so in total, there are many, many different forms of synesthesia. I know the font on this is small. The details don't matter. I just want to illustrate that almost any sense that you can think of that can crosstalk with some other sense in the brain, we have found cases of this somewhere. So what this means is that there's a lot of crosstalk that can happen in the brain that give people very different sorts of internal experiences, what they take to be reality. And the importance here is that synesthetes will live and die, they'll go their whole lives without ever knowing that they're seeing reality differently than the person sitting next to them, right? It's only in recent years when synesthesia is sort of getting into the media and there are television and radio shows about it, that people are realizing, oh, it might be that my internal reality is different than someone else's. And that's the sense in which we've been able to elevate this to a scientific problem. I want to mention that synesthesia is not called a disease or a disorder because it is not disadvantageous in any way. In fact, one of my grad students thinks that synesthetes are going to take over the world. And the reason is they tend to have a better memory. So if you have, let's say, colors associated with letters or numbers, then it's easier for you to remember things if you're at a cocktail party and someone introduces themselves to someone else. There are colors associated with that. Or if I were to tell you my phone number and you were to forget it a week later, you might think, oh yeah, it had this nice autumn pattern to it. And so that allows you to reconstruct it. So it turns out that every person we've been able to find who has one of these extraordinary memories, like these guys who can memorize pi out to 30,000 digits, you know, 3.14692, they all have synesthesia. They have very rich synesthesia. So for example, one of the guys who can memorize pi has fivefold synesthesia, where for him, every digit has a color, a texture, a shape, a personality, and a gender. So that when he's thinking about 6921, there's a whole story landscape going on there. And that's the way he's able to do it. So all of these people with untaxable memories have synesthesia. So it's not a disorder. By the way, I did put this only because the one disadvantage I ever found was this particular guy. For him, Mike and Abe happen to have the same colors in Dan and Robbie, so he'll confuse those names. Otherwise, no disadvantage. It turns out that many artists, not surprisingly, have leveraged their synesthesia into their greatest works. So Kandinsky had sound-to-vision synesthesia, and he would crank up his phonograph and stand in front of his canvas, and he would paint what he was seeing, what he was synesthetically experiencing. Okay, now how do you actually know? How do you know that these people aren't being artistic or metaphoric? Well, one of the things we've done in the last sort of 8 years is we've developed tests to be able to measure consistency with synesthetes. So this is how it works. This is the test that my lab developed. We present you with a random letter or number and a color palette, and we ask you to pick the color that best matches your internal synesthetic experience. So you drag this slider for the hues, and you drag this slider here for the saturation, and you can get any one of 16 million different colors that can be presented on your screen. So you find exactly the color for T, and you submit it, and then we present you with the next letter or number at random. Okay, in total, we present you with all the letters and numbers 3 times each in random order. So for a real synesthete, here are some results. I'm just plotting each letter in the color that was chosen. And here's what it is for a control subject who we ask to use free association or memory, anything that they can to try to pass the test, try to pretend they're a synesthete. And what you can see, the length of the bar here represents the variability in color space. And what you can see is that we can sensitively distinguish synesthetes from malingerers this way and know who's actually synesthetic. So this has turned out to be a very valuable thing. And now this is the gold standard test that every lab in the world uses. And we launched this online. If anyone's interested in testing themselves, it's synesthete.org. We've launched in 8 different languages now with interesting alphabets of all sorts. And we have all kinds of tests on it where we can measure all sorts of different forms of synesthesia. Why does this matter? It's because when I first got interested in synesthesia, there were some papers in the literature that typically had one subject in it, maybe up to 4 or 5 subjects. But nowadays, because of launching this online, these uncheatable batteries of tests online, we now have over 20,000 rigorously verified synesthetes. And nowadays, we're doing large-scale data analysis to really understand what's happening there, and we're looking at the behavior and the genetics and the neurobiology to understand how is it that somebody's reality can be different from someone else's. So I'm not going to go into any detail about this. I'll just mention a couple of things. For those who are interested, what causes synesthesia is it's increased crosstalk between brain areas. This is an unusual view of the brain. We're looking from the underside of the brain and with a part called the cerebellum removed. And the reason I need to show you from that angle is because there's a part of the brain here that's involved in the encoding of letters and numbers, and it happens to be neighbors with these areas of the brain involved in the encoding of color. And what happens in synesthetes is that these neighboring areas are talking with each other. There's a little bit of extra connectivity going on, such that when a synesthete sees a letter, they're actually kindling activity in these color areas. So it's a genuine perceptual experience caused by very subtle changes in the brain. Now, as far as understanding what those changes are, it turns out synesthesia runs in family trees. So we've been running genetic analyses on families. Essentially, you see how synesthesia marches through the family tree, and you chase down the genetics there. My grad student and I, a little while ago, crashed a wedding where the family had synesthesia. We got everyone to spit in spit kits, and that's how we're doing these studies. And what we're almost there. We've got a hot spot on one of the chromosomes. We don't know the gene yet. But it'll be very exciting when we find the gene in the next few months, because this will be the first hit in what I'm calling perceptual genomics. So everybody's running around pulling the genes for diabetes or predisposition to aortic stenosis or things like that. But there are all kinds of genetic differences between people that cause them to perceive reality differently. And so that's what we're going after, is what are those tiny molecular changes that cause people to see the world differently? Okay, I'm going to take a quick side tangent here to tell you about a tribe in South America that was recently discovered, and they have two symbols in their tribe, and one of these symbols is called Kiki, and one is called Buba. And I want you to guess which is which. So who thinks that that's Kiki and that's Buba? Okay, who thinks that's Buba and that's Kiki? Okay, well, it turns out I lied. There's no South American tribe. This is an old psychology test from the 60s, and it turns out everybody thinks that's Buba and that's Kiki. But why? I mean, that's really weird, right? Why does everyone map the shape onto the... Okay, what this implies is that maybe we're all synesthetic in some way, meaning the normal brains, non-synesthetic brains, have lots of crosstalk in them. It's just that we're not normally aware of that crosstalk between different domains. But in fact, there's a lot in our, even in our language, to suggest that these crosstalk connections are there and that we're sensitive to them. So when you think of all these things in the language like a loud shirt or cool jazz or sharp cheese, these are all synesthetic metaphors, and yet they stick around in the language because everyone kind of gets it. Presumably they were introduced by synesthetes, but our brains get what to do with that. And in fact, if I were to take a piano and hit the high note, ding, 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 and the low note, dong, 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 and I were to ask you which one is brighter, what would you say? Okay, and if I were to ask you which one is bigger, which would you say? Okay, well, that's crazy, right? Because all I'm doing is playing notes, and there's brightness, there's size. Okay, what does that mean? The fact that everybody answers that the high note is small and bright and this is larger and darker means that presumably these cross connections are existing in everybody's brain, and it's only when we look at the synesthetic population that we're getting an unobstructed view of those connections that are there, because they can explicitly talk about those connections and what their experiences are. Okay, if anyone's interested more about synesthesia, my book Wednesday's Indigo Blue has everything else about it. And if you want to test yourself, go to synesthete.org and test yourself online. Okay, so now I want to get back to now that we've covered how our brain serves up reality to us, I want to get back to a very deep issue, which is when we talk about you, what do we mean? Well, it turns out brains are not one thing. It's the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about a brain is it's made up of lots of competing subpopulations. And these subpopulations are all fighting it out to control what you do next. So the right way to think about the brain is like a parliament where you have these different political parties and they're battling it out to steer the ship of state. Because if you look at any parliament or Congress, I mean, if you look at Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians, they all love their country. They just have very different ways of thinking about how to go about things. And it's the same thing with these populations in your brain. They all want to do the best thing for you, but sometimes those are in conflict. So, for example, if I were to put a piece of chocolate cake in front of you, part of your brain wants to eat that. It's a rich glucose source. Part of your brain says, don't eat it, you're going to get fat. Okay, you can cajole yourself. You can contract yourself. You can get mad at yourself. Who's talking with whom exactly? Right? It's all you, but humans have this unique ability to feel conflicted. So if you go down to the interactive exhibits and look at all the coolest software and computers and so on, none of those are feeling conflicted. They have a set of instructions and they just go forward and do what they do. What this tells us right away is that there's something very different about human hardware and software than anything about the way we program computers now. And the key is you've got all these different parts that are battling it out. So nowadays we can use non-invasive neuroimaging. This is from MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. And we can actually peer non-invasively inside the human brain while people are making different sorts of decisions and tasks. And we can figure out what's happening in there. And I'll just summarize a decade of literature in one slide by saying when you're trying to make a decision between something, there are different competing networks. Some care about things like price point. They care about the logic. Other parts care about the emotional experience. Other parts care about the social context of it, what your friends think about it. And all these brains are constantly fighting it out with each other to control the ship of state. Because when you're standing there at the shelf, you're going to grab one or the other, but you don't grab both. You have to make a decision. And that's how brains fundamentally work on the inside. And I think that gives, I mean, I talk about this much more in the book, but I'll just say now, it gives us a much more nuanced understanding about ourselves, about why we act the way we do, and even ways of steering our own behavior. Because when we have temptations between the short term versus the long term, there are ways to structure our behavior while we're in a moment of sober reflection. There are things you can do, what's called a Ulysses contract, to put things into place such that you won't behave badly later. So for example, alcoholics who are trying to quit, you know, the first thing they do is they get rid of all the alcohol in their house, because they know that on a, you know, festive Saturday night or a lonely Sunday night, they're going to be too tempted if the alcohol is there. And so while they're thinking about it, they just need to get rid of it. So there are lots of ways that people can make Ulysses contracts in their lives, and this is something I'll, that's for the book, or I can answer more about that during the Q&A. But I think this gives us a richer understanding of ourselves, and what this leads me to do is circle back around to the big question here. So the big question is, we study the biology from the level of the molecules where drugs and medications take effect, to neurons, which I mentioned are as complicated as a city, to networks of these things, which is where the action really starts. And what I've told you so far is that everything about your behavior and your perception, your reality, is all contained in this 3-pound organ. So somehow you are inseparable from this alien computational material. And the reason I call it this is because it is the weirdest stuff. I mean, if you can imagine an alien spaceship crashing into the Earth, and we went and we pried the doors open and we found this sort of pink, weird, miniaturized, self-healing stuff that could contemplate the cosmos, we would say, my God, that's weird. But that's exactly what we find inside here. That is us. That's the situation we're in, is we are made up of this alien computational material. In any case, what we know is that we are inseparable from it. And it turns out that when the material changes, we change too. And that leads us right into the heart of some very deep ethical questions. So probably many of you have heard of Phineas Gage. If you took a high school or a college biology course, he was a young man working in Virginia who would tamp down gunpowder with a tamping rod so they could set off explosions to make railroads. And one day he accidentally caused a spark against a rock, and that caused an explosion, and the tamping rod blew through his head and clattered to the ground 50 yards away. Now, the reason it became a famous medical case is because he didn't die. And in fact, he didn't even lose consciousness. The first doctor who showed up at the scene didn't even believe what had happened until Phineas Gage leaned over and coughed and a teaspoonful of brain fell on the dust. But the reason it became a really famous medical case is because his personality changed entirely. So people who knew him said, Phineas Gage is no longer Phineas Gage. He's somebody else now. So he took to drinking and cussing and gambling and sleeping with prostitutes and things that were not part of his personality before. He just changed entirely. And so this was one of the first cases where people thought, wow, it really does seem that who you are, your essence, is tied to the integrity of your biological tissue, right? If that changes, you're going to change. Because we're in Austin, I'm curious how many people remember who Charles Whitman is. Okay, some number. So in 1966, Whitman climbed to the top of the tower at UT Austin, and he started shooting people indiscriminately. And in the end, he wounded 39 people and killed 14. He shot pedestrians. He shot the people who came to help them. He shot the ambulance drivers who came to help them. It was a completely random, bloody act of mass violence. And the only thing stranger than the act itself was that nothing about Whitman presaged that kind of behavior. He was an engineering student. He worked as a bank teller. He had been an Eagle Scout. He'd been honorably discharged from the Marines. He had a wife and a mother that lived with him. How could that have happened? Well, what happened is when the deputies got to the top of the tower finally and killed him, the next thing they did is they went to his home to see if they could figure this out, and they discovered that he had killed his wife and his mother the night before in their bed, and he'd written a suicide note on his typewriter. And he said, look, for the last year, things have been changing inside of me. By the way, Whitman was very high IQ. He had something like a 135 IQ. And he was very articulate. And he said, something inside of me has been changing. I've been fighting this anger. He said, I went to see a psychiatrist, but this was in 1966, so there wasn't much that could be done at that time. So he said the psychiatrist didn't do any good. And he said, when this is all over, I want there to be an autopsy performed. So that's exactly what happened. They did an autopsy on Whitman. What they found was a brain tumor. He had a brain tumor that was growing and was impinging on a part of his brain called the amygdala, which is an area involved in fear and aggression. And Whitman, over the course of a year in his diaries, was able to track the changes that he was feeling on the inside in terms of this irrepressible anger that finally led to this event. Here's a case from the more recent literature of a man who was a 40-year-old man, normal sexual appetite, and he started becoming a pedophile. And he'd never had any sort of sexual interest before in children, but now he started collecting up child pornography. He went to massage parlors to try to find young girls. And finally, when he made an inappropriate move on his prepubescent stepdaughter, his wife had him arrested. And the night before sentencing, because he was complaining of these worsening headaches, he finally couldn't stand the pain anymore. He went to the emergency room and he got a brain scan, and it turned out he had a massive frontal lobe tumor. So this is a horizontal slice of the brain. This is the front. And what you can see in this white area is a massive tumor in his frontal lobes. So he underwent an emergency surgery. The surgeons removed the tumor and his sexual behavior returned completely to normal. Now, this story has an interesting postscript because less than a year later, he started showing signs of pedophilia again. So his wife took him back to the doctor. It turns out the surgeons had missed a part of the tumor, which was now regrowing. They resected it a second time, and his behavior returned to normal a second time. So you are your brain, and when you look at things that are, you know, alcohol is universally administered to make people funnier at parties or more relaxed or whatever it is. Drugs of all sorts change people's behaviors. Does anyone know who this is? This is Chris Benoit, Worldwide Wrestling Federation champion, went home one night, killed his wife and his son, and then hung himself from one of the pulleys of his weight machine. It turned out upon investigation that his physician had conspired with him to give him 8 times the normal levels of testosterone in his body, and he was having a roid rage that completely navigated his decision-making. And then I list medications on here, too, because how many people know about what's been happening with Parkinson's medications and gambling? It turns out that back in 2003, people started to notice that these kind elderly folks with Parkinson's were becoming pathological gamblers. And they were blowing their family's money by flying out to Las Vegas or doing online gambling. And it turned out upon investigation that Parkinson's disease involves a neurotransmitter system called dopamine. And dopamine not only functions in the motor systems, but it serves a double duty in the reward systems. And when you dial the levels of dopamine around, it changes people's risk aversion. And so it turned these people into gamblers, and all that has to happen now, physicians are all aware of this, and so they just titrate the amount of the prescription until the gambling part goes away. But what this means, of course, is that you are the sum of your neurons and chemicals going on, and things like this are daily proof of that sort of principle. So nowadays, when we talk about morality and decision-making, what we're really talking about is the neural basis of that. Okay, well, this gets us into this very deep question at the heart of the legal system, which is, okay, well, what does this all mean for free will? Are the mind and the brain separate? Or are they the same thing? The problem is the legal system rests on 2 assumptions as we have it now. The first is that we are practical reasoners. This is at the heart of the legal system. We are free to choose how we act. And the second one is that all brains are equal. And that's a very charitable idea, but it's demonstrably false. Along any axis that you measure brains, you find a wide variety, whether that's empathy or aggression or impulse control or capacity to simulate futures and evaluate them. All of those things are very different across different brains. And the legal system assumes that if you're over 18 and if you have an IQ of over 70, then we should assume that your capacity to decide and make sound decisions is just like anybody else's. Okay, and the problem is that modern neuroscience suggests that neither of these are good assumptions at all. When we really start looking into the brain, neither of these hold up in any way. Now, what I need to make clear is, as we get better at biological explanations of behavior, does this mean we're going to let people off the hook? And the answer is no, not at all. What it leads to is rational sentencing and customized rehabilitation and better incentive structuring. In other words, as we understand the differences between brains and why people behave the way they do, we still have to take bad actors off the street. That has to go on. But what it means is that we don't have to imagine that all brains deserve exactly the same prison sentence length. We can modulate that based on probability of recidivism, what the problems are. And the biggest thing is we can try to help people. Instead of putting people in these repeated rounds of incarceration, we treat jail as a one-size-fits-all solution. But instead of doing that, we can have much better things that have lower cost and better utility to try to help people. Because once you stick someone in jail, you've broken their social circles, you've broken their employment opportunities, and you've set up this revolving door where they come back around. Okay. Something that struck me as interesting from Whitman's suicide note was how insightful he was. And he said, if my life insurance policy is valid, please pay off my debts and donate the rest anonymously to a mental health foundation. Maybe research can prevent further tragedies of this type. This is what he wrote just before going up on the tower and murdering all those people. Okay, so in that spirit, I started the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law some years ago, which is an organization of neuroscientists and ethicists and physicians and lawyers and policymakers that tries to understand how modern neuroscience will navigate and update the legal system. And there are many issues that we address. I just put some pictures down here, lie detection, the insanity defense, drug addiction, eyewitness testimony, and even how jurors' brains operate. So I just want to mention that if anybody's interested in this, go to newlaw.org, where we have readings and materials and so on. And if anyone's interested, it happens that on Tuesday, I'm going to be in a debate on whether it's time to end the war on drugs. And this is sort of a special debate here. Some of my fellow debaters. It's an online thing that is apparently going to be watched by up to 1 million people, and we're all going to debate whether it's time to end the war on drugs. And my argument is one from the point of view of neuroscience, why neuroscience matters for a rational drug policy. And the argument is that if you attack drug supply, that's always going to be a losing battle, because drug supply is like a water balloon. If you press it down in one place, it's going to expand somewhere else. If you want to address the drug problem, you have to address demand, which is the brain of the addict. And we know so much now about the circuitry and the pharmacology of drug addiction that there are a whole panoply of ways that we're coming up with of helping drug addicts. So instead of filling our prisons with drug addicts, there are much more fruitful ways that we can actually help people to break the addiction and get them out that way. So if anyone wants to come hear this debate, on March 13th, it's actually going to be splashed on the front page of YouTube. So if you go to YouTube that day, you can click in from there. Okay, so this is it. I want to wrap up, and then I'm going to take questions. So the key is, when we think about the brain, I think what this helps us get at is this Greek admonition to know thyself. In the modern view, it's something more like know thyself, because we're not one thing. We're a whole parliament. By the way, I said this to Stephen Colbert, that your brain's like a parliament. He said, are you saying my brain is British? So, sort of. So this is our modern view of understanding it. And what's really strange about it is that we have a lot less control than we thought, right? I mean, the big lesson about the unconscious brain is that just about everything happening under there is not something that you can consciously access. So that's sort of weird. But it's not the first time that we've seen this sort of dethronement. So in 1610, Galileo built a telescope and saw the moons of Jupiter, and that shattered the celestial spheres. And he finally had proof that the Earth was not at the center of the orbits. And what happened is religious critics decried this as a dethronement of man from his position at the center of things. And you know that Galileo was thrown into a dungeon and forced to recant this idea that the Earth was not at the center. But it turns out that dethronements have an upside, because what we've realized in the intervening few centuries is that the cosmos is so much bigger and grander and more subtle than we could have ever imagined. So it turns out that this idea that Earth is at the center is pretty cool, but what we now know is so much cooler, that our sun is one of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which is one of 100 billion other galaxies. And every one of those stars out there has any number of planetary bodies rotating around with unimagined biological civilizations on it. I mean, even if you imagine that the chances of having life on a planet are 1 in a billion, that still leaves at least 1 billion planets out there with life on it. So our understanding has grown so much more subtle and wondrous. And I argue that the same thing is happening in neuroscience. What we're realizing is we're not really at the center of ourselves the way we thought we were. Instead, our conscious mind is sort of out on a distant edge of the galaxy, just hearing whisperings of what's going on in there. And yet, by diving into this inner cosmos, as modern neuroscience is, what we're realizing is that we're finding life forms in there that are more subtle and wondrous than we could have ever imagined. And as I said, we found the most complex thing we have ever found in the universe, and it is us. So that's all I'm going to say, and I'll take questions. Thanks so much for your attention. Yes. The question is there a way to tap into that unconscious mind in a conscious way? And people have different opinions about this, but I actually don't think so. I think we wouldn't understand the language of it if we did. It would sort of be if you were watching a video on YouTube and you cracked the cover off and you started measuring from a single transistor in your computer, you'd see that transistor chattering between voltage states, and it wouldn't tell you why the sneezing panda is funny or not, right? So that's the sense in which, as we go deeper and deeper into the system, I don't think we speak that language. I don't think it has meaning to us as humans. There are monks and so on who can control their blood flow or control their heart rate and so on, and that's cool, but that's really just scratching the surface. They're just dipping their toes in the ocean of the unconscious. The relationship between synesthesia and dyslexia, to my knowledge, there is no relationship, except that synesthetes sometimes will have a difficult time with mathematics because they'll add some numbers and they'll say, well, the colors don't match. I can't be that, you know, yellow and blue makes purple or whatever it is. So I saw another hand. Yes. The question is, when we think about synesthesia, which is a connection between, let's say, letters and colors, what would happen if you had more and more connections between all kinds of things? It's a great question. It's not known. It's thought that perhaps this might be the basis of metaphor or creativity. And if I could have had the opportunity to give Shakespeare a brain scan, I would have expected that he's probably got lots of crosstalk because he was so good at taking things from, let's say, the emotional realm and mapping those onto some sort of physical metaphor. And so it may be that you get creativity, or maybe you get madness out of that. But anyway, those are all open questions because neuroscience is just at the foot of that mountain. Yes. In the case of the sudden pedophile, why pedophilia? This is a very interesting question. It turns out that there are all sorts of flavors of brain damage that people get where they'll become hypersexual or sexual in some very particular way. And what this unmasks is, in some sense, drives that are deep down in there, and yet they are being squelched by the machinery of socialization, which is essentially your frontal lobe. And so what this means for this gentleman who is in the medical literature, it means that some part of his brain liked children like that. And remember, you know, evolutionarily speaking, a girl who's reached puberty is, evolutionarily attractive. And so there's some part of his brain that wants that, and it's being squelched by these other things. And we see this all the time when people get frontal lobe damage, that all this stuff comes out. They'll urinate in public, they'll shoplift, they'll be physically or sexually transgressive. And what essentially you're doing is unmasking the software programs that have been running down there but squelched. based on synesthesia. The question is there any way that we're changing the way we teach our kids to memorize based on synesthesia? I mean, in general, if you try to memorize a poem, it's really difficult. But if you are memorizing the lyrics to a song, that's very easy. Why? Because you get to tag everything with this extra dimension of information, the music. What happens with synesthetes is they're just tagging things with this extra dimension also. So in some sense, every time we teach kids a song or, you know, some memorizing thing like that, we're using these synesthetic principles. What I thought you were going to ask is there any way that our kids are learning differently nowadays based on the internet? And that's, you know, that's clear that the next generation of kids, and probably sort of all of us are right on that transitional thing, it's just completely different what's happening with our brains. Maybe I'll put that off and come back to that if anyone else wants to hear about that. Yeah. The gut. Well, it turns out that when we talk about a gut feeling that's metaphorical, all of the computation is happening up here. It does turn out that there is a huge amount of information that goes between the brain and physically to the gut, as well as all the rest of the body. But when we talk about a gut feeling, what we really mean is computations that are happening in the brain, which often incorporate a lot of information from the whole body, like my muscles are tight, my stomach feels constricted, my heart's beating faster. Those things are all fed into the decision-making mechanism. So that's what people mean by a gut feeling. And it's possible, I mean, many of us argue that we're never going to get artificial intelligence right unless it's embodied, unless it has a body from which it can feel these feelings. Yes? Yeah, the question is about multiple personality disorder. You know, I don't know, because that is such a debated thing in the field. There are people who seem to have very convincing stories of that, and yet the medical community in general feels like it's simply not true. So I don't know. Ask me again in a year about that. It's a great question. Yes. You know, I have, actually. The question is about parasites and free will or motivation. I mean, let me say in general, in Incognito, I wrote a little section about viruses and how they can affect us. Let me just give you this example, because this is an example of how biology is so beautiful. The rabies virus is, you know, a hundred billionth of the size of us, right? But if you get bitten by a rabid animal, the rabies virus climbs up your nerves and into your temporal lobe, where it influences your behavior. It also goes into your salivary glands. And what it does with influencing your behavior is tries to get you to bite people so that you can pass it on. So this little rabies virus essentially commands the whole ship and gets you to pass it on that way. I mean, it's incredible, right? And so if you ask a rabid animal, well, do you have free will or not? And the answer is kind of no, right? The little virus is controlling it. I'm afraid my time is up here, but I will be signing books and I'll be happy to answer any other questions in the book line. Thank you so much.